You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, September the 20th. Well, with the anniversary of 9/11 and the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina being commemorated in recent weeks, questions about homeland security and preparedness are back in the forefront. But our guest this hour says when it comes to protecting the homeland and our own personal homeland security, we are our own worst enemy. Wonder why he says that. He says because we are focusing on the wrong questions and the wrong threats, like how do we win the war on terror? How do we prevent Al-Qaeda from smuggling a nuclear weapon into a U.S. port? What can we do to prevent a biological attack on a U.S. city? What will FEMA do for my family during a crisis? And why are American cities unprepared for mass evacuations? These, he says, are the wrong questions. We'll find out what the right ones are in just a moment. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Colonel Randall J. Larson, retired U.S. Air Force, director of the Institute for Homeland Security, author of a number of books, most recently Our Own Worst Enemy, Asking the Right Questions About Security to Protect You, Your Family, and America. And Colonel Larson joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So why do we win the war on terror is the wrong question to ask?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of leaders here in Washington, D.C. like to ask that question. You'll hear a lot of them out on the campaign trail next year, this year and next year, you know, talking about that. But it's an impossible thing. It's like saying, how do we win the war against kamikazes or blitzkrieg? Terrorism is a type of warfare. Now, some people say I'm being a little bit too picky. They say, well, that's just a euphemism for the war against Al-Qaeda. Well, even that, we need to understand what that means. Yeah, theoretically, I guess we could kill or capture everyone in Al-Qaeda, but the issue of homeland security would not go away when that happens, because what has really changed and what causes us to worry about the security of our homeland is not any one individual or any one group. 50 years ago, Osama bin Laden would just been an angry guy in the desert with a rifle. He would not have been a threat to your families in Wisconsin. What's changed is technology. The fact that terrorist organizations could have access to nuclear weapon, biological weapons, cyber weapons, that they could come here and these enormous amounts of chemicals we have stored throughout our urban areas could be turned into weapons against us. It's that technology that's not going to go away. So I get very nervous when I hear a president say, well, we have to have different rules and change things here until we win this war. Well, we're never going to win that war. So I don't like when people say we're going to change rules until the war is over, because it's not going to be over. We need to understand that. It's difficult for politicians to go out and be very honest with the public and say, you know, that this we can't win this war. But what we can do, and what I try to explain in the book, is how we can contain it if we ask the right questions, if we establish the right priorities. Then terrorism is going to be down on our list of worries. You know, we all got to worry. You know, we worry about drunk drivers out there. You know, we worry about crime. We worry about natural disasters. I would like to move terrorism down below those worries that we all have to deal with. But unfortunately, since we're asking the wrong questions right now, terrorism's near the top of my list of worries.
So, how do you suggest we contain terrorism if it's not going after all of the terrorists?
Well, no, that's certainly the first step that I have. A chapter on strategy is this relentless pursuit of those people who are getting us. But just understanding that's like saying we're going to have a relentless pursuit of drug drivers, bank robbers, or crooked politicians. You know, we can kind of contain them, but they're still going to be there. I think the 9/11 Commission, one of their recommendations that's most overlooked is our diplomacy overseas, our information campaign. I don't quote Donald Rumsfeld very often, but there's one quote he used I liked. It says, in the information warfare operations, the United States is in the five and dime era, and our enemy is operating in the eBay era. We're defeated every day in the information campaign, which is so important. Now, I quote Bill Clinton in the book because he and George Bush were out touring the world, these big disaster areas, and they said one of the most important things we have done to win the support of in countries like Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim nation in the world, and Pakistan, of course, where a lot of this radical Islam is taking place. When America went out there and took aid to the tsunami victims and aid to the earthquake victims in Pakistan, they went to refugee camps, and he said in refugee camps in those two distant countries, the one thing he noticed that was the same, young children sitting there with crayons, coloring, they were coloring pictures of helicopters that was dropping food, and those were American helicopters. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of operations go a very long way. Another story I tell is I met an Indonesian rock musician by the name of Donny. I refer to him as the John Lennon of Indonesia. It's just amazing. If you watch his videotapes, it reminds me when the Beatles came to New York City. And I remember the tape. You couldn't even hardly hear the Beatles singing because all the kids were screaming so loud. Well, that's what it sounds like when you get Donny into a stadium in Indonesia. He was raised by a father who was a very radical Muslim, put him, Donnie, in madras schools. But Donnie discovered rock and roll music when he was about 15, and he said, rock and roll's about love and peace, not about hate and violence. And so he broke away. He adopted a form of Islam called Sufism, which is a more spiritual form, not practiced much in the Middle East, but it's become quite popular in Indonesia. And he is trying to educate the youth in Indonesia that this violence and terrorism is not the way to go. So those sorts of information mm-hmm. campaigns mm-hmm. are extremely important in our foreign aid program. And other things that we have done that have made us more secure here, the fact that after 9/11 we went to Afghanistan, that we took down the Taliban, which was providing sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. We've made it more difficult for the terrorists to transfer money in the international monetary system. We've made it more difficult for them to travel. So there are certain things we have done right. Of course, the biggest mistake we made was at Tora Bora when we let bin Laden get away. Mm-hmm. Now, killing bin Laden does not, once again, end the threat, but it would have been very nice to take down the guy who did attack the World Trade Center twice.
Yeah. So do you think, Colonel Larson, that the threat of terrorism or the threat of another terrorist attack in this country is overhyped?
Well, you know, some people say we haven't been hit in 6 years. This is maybe just a one-time kind of thing. Unfortunately, no. We've got to remember, between the 93 attack on the World Trade Center and 9/11 was 8 years. And we weren't doing a lot to disrupt them at that time. We've done a lot to disrupt them at this time. Yes, I am concerned that there are people out there that dislike the United States so much that they're willing to come here. And, I mean, we've seen the Brits recently arrested people over there that were going to put bombs on 10 airplanes coming to the United States. Just a few weeks ago, the Germans broke up a cell that had several thousand pounds of high-powered explosives they were going to use. I would like to say, you know, I get kids and grandkids living down in Texas, and I'd just like to say now they don't have to worry about this. But the fact is, it is something that we're going to have to deal with, which is why we have to ask the right questions. And so in my book, I try to say the two things that could really disrupt this nation, that could kill a lot of people, destroy our economy, and cause us to overreact, to do things that, you know, that would involve civil liberties, privacies, our criminal justice system that frighten me, are nuclear weapons and biological weapons, which is where I think we need to focus our efforts. And frankly, I got a lot of support in that from Senator Nunn and Senator Lugar and Senator Barack Obama. You heard in the last presidential debate, the first presidential debate of the last campaign between Kerry and Bush, both of them said, you know, preventing proliferation of nuclear weapons was their number one priority if they became president. Bush was elected, and as I lay out in the book, clearly this is not his number one priority, and we're suffering because of that. We spend about $1 billion a year to basically prevent a mushroom cloud over an American city.
Yeah,
and we spend that every 4 days in Iraq. Do we have our priorities right, Joy? Mm.
You say that one of the right questions to ask is, how do we prevent a terrorist organization from becoming a nuclear power?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, see, the wrong question that Congress has been asking is, how do we prevent them from smuggling a nuclear weapon into a seaport that you mentioned at the opening of the show. Mm-hmm. And they just passed legislation that's going to require 100% scanning of all these 8 million containers that come in the country every year. That's not going to make your family any more secure. Do you think if a terrorist got their hands on a nuclear weapon, they'd actually put it in a 40-foot container, put a real good padlock on it, and turn it loose in that global transportation system where 5 or 6 different companies would touch it before it got here? They would never take their hands off of it. They'd probably charter an airplane, file a flight plan, and fly it here. So the right question to ask is, how do we prevent them from becoming a nuclear power? And that's the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which is trying to locate, lock down, and eliminate the loose nuclear material out there. That's the best investment for making your family secure.
Yeah. So the seaport scanning system is a big waste of money?
Well, we put, right after 9/11, they deployed $200 million worth of scanners out there that detect kitty litter more reliably than they detect Hiroshima-style bombs. Nice. They're just a total waste. Now they're talking about $1.2 billion that Congress just passed this legislation, $1.2 billion to put this new generation out there. The GAO just came out last week with a big study that said the government gave inside information to the contractors so they could do better in the test. That's not my opinion. That's the Government Accountability Office that's claiming that last week in a congressional hearing. And even more importantly, if someone's smart enough to get their hands on a nuclear weapon, they're probably smart enough to put a 1/4-inch lead box around it. And if you do, not even these new detectors would detect it. So it's just, it makes them feel good. It's something good to use out on the campaign trail. Oh, we're scanning everything coming into your seaports. Feel more secure. It makes your family less secure because we're spending money where we could spend it far more productively in another area.
Yeah, and another area that you think we should be focused on is this the biological threat of...
Yes, ma'am. I'm the National Security Advisor to the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. I've been doing that since 1994. That's what really got me involved in the whole Homeland Security business. This concern, because of the biotechnical revolution that is just producing marvelous new drugs and treatments for us that is just incredible, unfortunately, there's also a dark side to that. And we are very concerned about what terrorist organizations could do with biological weapons. The problem is that too many people in this town say, what do we do to prevent a biological attack? Well, unfortunately, you can't. What we have to be spending our money on is be prepared to rapidly detect, respond, and recover. I demonstrate that very dramatically in the first page of the book. 9 days after 9/11, I was asked to go to the White House to talk to some people there about, did I believe Al-Qaeda had the capability to launch a biological attack? Now, remember, this is before the October anthrax. This is just 9 days after 9/11. And I didn't have any special security clearances. I was retired from the military. I was no different than you. I had to show 2 IDs to get in there and go through 15 minutes of screening. During the presentation, Vice President Cheney says, what's a biological weapon look like? And I pulled a test tube of weaponized Bacillus guilvegii out of my pocket and says, sir, it looks like this. And by the way, I just smuggled it into your office.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks later, I carried it into CIA headquarters. We do that to demonstrate that no detection system in seaports or airports or whatever could prevent someone from bringing it here. The biotechnical revolution has made it possible for them to make it. And I make a very strong argument in the book that the FBI totally messed up the largest investigation they've ever done in their history about the anthrax attack of October 2001. I am convinced it was Al-Qaeda behind that attack. Joy, before you read the book, did you know that Mohammed Atta's roommate, Atta's the guy that flew American Flight 11 into the World Trade Center, do you know that his roommate was treated for anthrax in Florida in June of 2001?
I actually did hear the press accounts at the time, and I remember being puzzled by that. You didn't hear a whole lot more about it, though.
It was one day's report by Bill Broad in the New York Times, and other than that, boom, it's gone. And because we were so focused, that's about the time everything was heating up in Afghanistan when we were attacking there. Most people just totally missed that story. And we would have never found out about it, but after the FBI found out it about a week after the anthrax story broke, and the doctor who treated Otis's roommate said on the story, he called the FBI. The FBI said on it, didn't act on it. They were very convinced it was this American doctor that worked for the military, and they never really followed up on it. And only because a disgruntled FBI employee faxed it to an associate of mine at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, who happened to have written the definitive article on anthrax in the Journal of American Medical Association, were we able to look into this and say, well, and there's about 8 pages in there that discusses all of the other issues that demonstrate that. So that causes us great concern that we believe that terrorist organizations, not just Al-Qaeda, but other terrorist organizations now have the capability to do that. Now, the good news in this is, you know, when you go out and you buy a stealthy bomber or a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, well, okay, that's what you get. But when where we really need to be spending money right now for the biodefense is on research and development for new vaccines and new treatments. The good news about that is we are learning a lot by investing in that that's going to help us against, first of all, diseases from Mother Nature may bring here, like pandemic flu, SARS, or whatever, but other things using for in treatment of chronic diseases or whatever. So these are really valuable investments in America to do this, to improve our public health and medical care delivery.
We are talking with Colonel Randall Larson, author of Our Own Worst Enemy, Asking the Right Questions About Security to Protect You, Your Family, and America. The book examines the deficiencies and oversights in homeland security, talks about the real threats, according to our guest, and how money is being wasted on things that are not as important. Welcoming your thoughts and questions for him, and wondering if you feel this country is prepared for the next emergency, or if you personally are prepared. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon for At Issue. And after 5, Ben's guest will discuss how the standardized testing movement has affected students, teachers, and school administrators across the country. He talks with the author of the book Tested, One American School's Struggles to Make the Grade. That's after 5 this afternoon. We are talking long-term strategy when it comes to homeland security and how this country and ourselves personally can be prepared. Our guest is Randall Larson. He is a retired colonel from the U.S. Air Force, director of the Institute for Homeland Security, and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, Asking the Right Questions About Security to Protect You, Your Family, and America. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Colonel Larson, explain why you think we're being our own worst enemy.
Well, by asking the wrong questions and establishing the wrong priorities, we are wasting a lot of money and a lot of effort. I don't think we've been talking at the top level. I say this book goes from the Oval Office to the front office of corporations, down to local communities, and all the way to your kitchen table. Let's go down to the bottom of that spectrum and come up now for a few minutes, because so many families, all the Red Cross surveys that I have seen in the past 2 years say that less than half of American families and small businesses are properly prepared for a disaster, whether it's a flood, an ice storm, a hurricane, earthquake, or a terrorist attack. And that's sort of irresponsible. You know, Joy, when you think about how much of our lives do we spend providing, you know, economic well-being for our family, and we make sure that our children are properly educated, and we provide our family health care. But we don't seem to take this security and safety thing nearly as important. And it's just a small investment in time and money to do it. What I recommend that every family, every person above the age of 12 should go to the Red Cross and get first aid and CPR training. I took my youngest daughter last year, and it was great. I haven't had a refresher since I retired from military 8 years ago, and my daughter had never been. And it's a great family experience to go do it. And, you know, things have changed. You don't do the Heimlich maneuver anymore if someone's choking. I didn't realize that has changed. They even changed the procedures for CPR in the past few years. Mm-hmm. So we could save hundreds, thousands of lives in this country every year, whether it's a huge disaster or not, just by doing that. The other thing that's very important is every family should have a transportation plan, a communications plan, and a readiness kit. And the most important thing in that readiness kit is prescription medications. We had so many people show up in the Astrodome in Houston when they fled Katrina and said, oh, I take 8 pills a day. It's really important. I got all these chronic diseases. And then the doctors in the Astrodome said, what are they? And they said, well, there's a little yellow one, and there's a pink one, and a green one. And I said, no. You know, so you need to have, what I recommend is everyone always have at least a 2-week supply of your prescription medicine in your home, and that you, and if you have something set up for your readiness kit where you could use to evacuate, you need to have it in the bottles that says what the medicines are. In your office, you should have a 2 to 3 day supply of really important medicines. One of the wrong questions that people often ask, in fact, 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post, top story, front page, Washington, D.C. and major cities not prepared for a rapid mass evacuation. The fact is, with the exception of a hurricane where there's 2 to 3 days advance notice, there are no scenarios where you would want to do a rapid mass evacuation. So you don't have many hurricanes in Wisconsin.
No.
So none of your cities need to spend money spent working on things like that. It's not just Randy Larson. The American Red Cross agrees with me, and so does the Department of Homeland Security. The best thing to do is shelter in place, either at your office, your home, or your school. The one thing the Red Cross always asks me to remind people is sheltering in place is the best option if you have done a modest amount of preparation. And the most important thing I'm talking about is those prescription medicines are so important. But water, and we give examples in there. In fact, there's a page. I was very pleased my publisher just put a page in there that you can just tear out of the book. It's got the checklist. You can go down to the local store, and for a small amount of money, you can buy what you need to have these essential things. And I'm not saying, you know, you go out and buy 6 months worth of food. Food is the least important thing to have in your readiness kit. You can go 2 weeks without eating. So, and the other thing we talk about in there is the chapter about local communities, and it's called 911 is a local call. And I should have put a subtitle to that chapter saying, and in a crisis, that number will be busy.
Right, no one's going to answer.
What I'm saying is local communities need to be better prepared to take care of themselves. And I give 3 examples of a high-rise condominium in Manhattan, a rural county in Texas, and a suburban community in the hills of Oakland, California, that's right on top of one of the largest fault lines in America. What those communities have done to become better prepared for primarily for natural disasters, but it works very well for a terrorist incident also. We should not be looking, and one of the questions you mentioned at the top of the show is, I believe, was, you know, what's FEMA going to do for my family in a crisis? Don't plan on anything, okay? That's the best thing. FEMA is a very small organization. If they were fully manned, they only have 2,500 people, and I don't think they're above 2,000 right now. Disasters are the primary response will always be at the local community, and so a small amount of preparation on your part can give your family a great return on investment.
I certainly want to go back to the phones, but what did you make of the advice that we were supposed to have plastic and duct tape to prevent the biological
well,
attack?
Joy, every home should have duct tape. I've used it for so many things in my life, but not for terrorism, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my mom called me from Colorado. Should I go buy duct tape? And they asked me that on Crossfire that night when I was on CNN. I said, well, I know a few politicians around here. We could put the duct tape over their mouth. Might make America more secure. But other than that, there's so many other things that we have on that checklist that you should go buy. Duct tapes. I don't even think duct tape made my list.
That's not on there. Let's go to the phones. Lots of callers to talk with you. Mark in Onalaska. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Great subject. Great guest.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the 60s. I don't trust the system, but if you're not going to trust the system, you got to be part of it. I sit on a board that oversees the community right to know law, and we run headlong into Homeland Security all the time. And actually, I agree with the guest. The threats are greatest internally than they are externally. And I don't think keeping information from the public is going to prevent anybody that wants to really be a terrorist from getting at it anyway. So keeping people in the dark doesn't solve anything.
Yeah, are we being kept in the dark, do you think, Colonel Larson?
Oh, you know, there The government removed a lot of things from the internet after 9/11. It was amazing how much information was on the web about building weapons of mass destruction. I'm particularly glad that was removed. There is a great debate going on with the academic community right now, which I think is probably the best example. Because of the research that's being done in biotechnology and advanced biotechnology at major universities, the publication of that information actually makes it easier for terrorist organizations to develop biological weapons, and particularly the even more difficult ones that would be resistant to our vaccine and antibiotics. So there's a big debate about, because, you know, when you're in the academic community, publishing is, you know, that's what you do. That is the big way you move up the ladder. And there is great concern about publishing this information, like some scientists did in Australia here 2 years ago, about how they could, using something called interleukin-4, make the smallpox virus resistant to our vaccine. That's a frightening concept. And people go, my goodness, why are they publishing that in open literature? Well, it's because of academic freedom like that. You know, the information age does give us many challenges that we have to deal with now, and some folks at my center spend serious time looking at that, but, you know, I'm a big supporter of the First Amendment. I do take on the press a little bit in the book, particularly the New York Times, when they published the story about SWIFT, which was that financial exchange organization over there in Europe that we were collecting. The intelligence community was collecting a lot of information about terrorist transfer of funds. They kind of blew the cover on that, the New York Times, and they first defended it, and then 5 months later, the ombudsman for the New York Times came back and said, we were wrong for revealing that story. The U.S. government was doing nothing wrong. It was providing valuable information, and it was a very secret program. So many things, you know, and I say in the book, I don't have answers for that particular question about freedom of the press. I have my own public radio show called Homeland Security, and now I'm a journalist. I have a hard time defining who's a journalist now, Joy. Is someone with a blog a journalist, and can they protect their sources like a New York Times reporter? What do you think?
Well, they think so. Anne in Madison is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a good program. I object to the double standard the United States has. They think nukes and other WMDs are fine for us, but they're not permitted for anyone the Bush administration labels an enemy. And it's paranoid secrecy, as the last caller mentioned. But one example, I think, of something very strange by our executive branch, basically, is that several weeks ago, a plane flew with either five or six nuclear bombs from Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And the five or six people involved in sending these nukes, packaging them up and so forth, have all died in accidents since the nuke's shipment. And one nuke is apparently unaccounted for. How do you interpret this incident? I understand that no nukes have flown by air in the U.S. since 1968, and it's not permitted by law.
You know, that as a, I'm a retired Air Force pilot. My last flying job, I was the commander of the VIP fleet at Andrews Air Force Base that carries the country's executives around. You know, I was shocked. I can't even tell you how shocked I was that an airplane carried five nuclear weapons from North Dakota, Louisiana, and nobody knew about it until it landed. The systems we have had to safeguard nuclear weapons, I have always felt very secure until about a week ago, and then my goodness, what's going on here? Now, I haven't heard this story about people associated that being dying. I know some people were fired right away, which absolutely should have happened. I hope that the U.S. Congress does a very thorough investigation of this, and I think a lot of people should be fired up the chain of command. That is just unconscionable that something like that could happen with nuclear weapons. Now, to your first point about the dual standard, that's certainly an argument that people can use. Virtually all the nations of the world have signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And, you know, most people don't realize, I mentioned this in the book, the ultimate goal of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is the elimination of all nuclear weapons. And the United States signed that, saying that's the ultimate goal. Now, I don't know if we're going, I guarantee you we will not see that in our lifetime, but that is the ultimate goal, to eliminate all nuclear weapons.
We are talking with Randall Larson, a colonel, a retired colonel from the U.S. Air Force, director of the Institute for Homeland Security, and author of the new book, Our Own Worst Enemy, Asking the Right Questions About Security to Protect You, Your Family, and America. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you have a question or a comment on the current state of homeland security as a nation, or your own personal homeland security as an individual or family. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, the Iraqi government has charged the American security firm Blackwater with civilian deaths in an incident last weekend. And coming up, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will examine the role of private contractors in Iraq. That's after 9. She talks with Jeremy Scahill, who is a journalist and author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. We are talking with Colonel Randall Larson. He is the author of Our Own Worst Enemy, Asking the Right Questions About Security to Protect You, Your Family, and America. And Lynn in Winona, Minnesota joins us now. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm wondering if the colonel could kind of talk to the public about financial responsibility for Americans and kind of saving that up. I come from an area of the Midwest that was just flooded recently, and people didn't even have a couple thousand dollars to buy a car, you know, for a couple weeks, you know, a junker to drive, and people were in desperate need, and they don't even have $100 to their name. And does he condone putting any money away in your home, you know, a couple $100, or what's the financial responsibility that citizens should have for a disaster?
Let me address two things there about responsibility preparing for disaster. I talk about a case. I remember when Hurricane Wilma hit Florida a couple of years ago, and I was sitting watching cable TV, and there was a long line of people standing there waiting to get drinking water. And the camera crew walked up to them. There was this one woman. And it was hot. It was very humid. This woman was very irate. She said, "This is ridiculous. We've been standing in line for 3 hours to try to get drinking water. Where's FEMA? Where's the state of Florida? Whatever." Well, you know, I was sitting there watching it, and I go, okay, she had... It was either 2 to 3 days advance notice that her community knew that they were going to get hit. And the storm had only passed over 36 hours ago. Why was she already out of drinking water? And then a couple days later, I talked to the deputy mayor of that small town, and she told me, you know, the Walmart a half mile down the road was open. They didn't have electricity, but it was open, and they were selling drinking water for their bottled water for the normal price. So, you know, do people think that the federal government is there to take care of you from cradle to grave and you don't have any responsibility to prepare at all? I mean, you know, she probably had 40 to 60 gallons of drinkable water in her hot water heater in her home or apartment that we need to understand would be there and how to use that. Now, specifically on the financial thing, absolutely. It's on our checklist that we have in the book there, and I have a large sum of cash that I keep available for a situation like that. I also mentioned I have a credit card that I keep in my readiness kit that I don't use. And so one time when I lost my wallet just before I was getting ready to leave on a big trip, I had to call up and cancel all my credit cards. And they go, well, now that's kind of dumb. Now you're not going to have a credit card. You know what? I just pulled that credit card out of my readiness kit, and I had my passport for identification to get me through the airport. I didn't have any problem at all. So there's many things that being prepared can help you out, even as simple as losing your wallet. But absolutely, I recommend that you have a certain amount of cash in there. I'm not going to tell you how much. I have more than some people have, but I think that's very important. Preparing all the way from having drinking water to cash to all those other things, because do not expect the federal government to help you, particularly in the first 72 to 96 hours. Now, you know, there's a good chance they'll come in with low-cost loans and grants to help you rebuild your house or maybe get your business restarted, but don't expect them to be there the first week.
Yeah. Deacon in Sheboygan, hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Excellent program. I know a lot of time and effort goes into the first two questions, if and when something happens. But how much time and effort actually goes into why? Why do people around the world and organizations around the world need and feel that they want to do things to us as a people or as a nation? Instead of the if and when, why? You know, and how much are we doing to try to change this mindset? Thank you.
I think that's an excellent question, and one of the critiques of my book that I have listened to is that I don't spend enough time addressing that specific issue. You know, there are certain things I talked about earlier in the show about how we are. I think one of the best things the U.S. government does is when we provide relief after their disasters around the world, and to demonstrate that we, you know, we're a good nation, we like to help people or whatever. But there are reasons. I mean, you know, we have a small percent of the world's population, and we use a huge percentage of the natural resources of the world. That is going to always cause us to, you know, people not like us or whatever. But you also have to look at the current primary enemy, which is radical Islam. You know, we're talking about, you know, people say, well, what can we do to make them like us? Absolutely nothing is the answer to that. These are people, you look at how they ruled in Afghanistan. I mean, it wasn't that, not only that women couldn't hold elected office, they couldn't vote, they couldn't even go to school, they couldn't get medical care. I mean, you know, when you have a society that says only a woman doctor can treat a woman, but let's see, women can't go to school, so how do they become doctors? I mean, you know, when you're dealing with people like that, when there is no freedom of religion, there's no freedom of press, no freedom of expression, I know no way that I can think of about how we could make those people like us.
Yeah, you don't think more diplomacy, maybe some adjustments in foreign policy, maybe getting more involved in the Middle East peace process?
For the vast majority of the moderate Muslim world, I completely agree. Trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue, getting U.S. troops out of the Middle East, many of those things would be very beneficial to a large percentage of the Muslim world. For those who follow al-Qaeda, I just don't see anything, frankly.
Yeah. How nervous are you, Colonel Larson, with the heightened tensions, especially between Israel and Iran?
Well, I am extremely concerned. In fact, I was in a meeting yesterday with some strategists sitting and talking about the great concern we have there. I see some of these people, these retired generals on cable TV, one particular three-star retired general, well, we could take out 3,200 aim points in 3 or 4 days, and we could just take out their nuclear capability and everything. And I go, you know, will someone please ask the question, and then what?
Mm-hmm.
Do they think that Iran would not react to that? Do they realize that the Persian Gulf would be closed and no oil would come out of there? It would put the entire world into a global economic depression. The terrorist attacks they could release. We're very worried about Iran's capability to launch a biological attack if they felt their nation was threatened, because they have a very sophisticated pharmaceutical industry. We're not talking about a terrorist organization here. We're talking about a nation state with a sophisticated pharmaceutical industry that could launch an enormous attack on the United States if they were provoked to do it. So I am very worried about this belligerent attitude towards Iran. My opinion has been this for many years since I was in graduate school. We are going to have to learn how to deal with controlled proliferation rather than non-proliferation. Just to say that no one else can ever have a nuclear weapon because we got them, but you can't have them. I'm very concerned about us over now. I see Iran as a threat. They it's not that there's some bunch of nice guys out there. I just see the idea of the United States or Israel attacking Iran right now will put the world in a far, far more dangerous place than the world would be if Iran has 2 or 3 nuclear weapons.
Lisa in Black Earth, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question much closer to home. Mm-hmm. This occurred actually just this week. I have a public relations agency, and my job is to work with media in the area around the country. I have a client in Canada. I have many clients in Canada, but this one makes something made of cloth, textiles, and it got held up in customs, and I got a call from FedEx asking me on behalf of Homeland Security, what is the cloth made of? What content of polyester or cotton is it? And they said, said it was marked as $300 in value, and they told me anything over $5 in value with the contents listed as textiles will raise a red flag, and you will not be allowed to receive it without filling in a specific federal tax form. I had to give all kinds of private information on my taxpayer ID number, even though all I was just was the recipient, not the shipper. I had to verify the content, the material that it was made out of. It was very weird. And FedEx said that particularly they're watching for textiles. Anyway, it kept me from doing my job for four days.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, that's, you know, let me tell you what. That's one of the reasons the book is titled Our Own Worst Enemy. I think many Americans, now folks up in Wisconsin probably understand this, but I'd say the majority of Americans don't understand it. Canada is our largest trading partner. And the disruption of commerce across that international border has been horrendous since 9/11 because of ridiculous programs like this. The most ridiculous one I've seen regarding transportation is one that I identify in the beginning of the book. It was about Transportation Security Administration said, we want to fingerprint everyone who has a commercial driver's license with a permit to carry hazardous cargo. And when you first hear that, you go, well, yeah, I guess we wouldn't want known terrorists getting a permit to carry hazardous cargo. But then when you find out that it's 2.7 million people have that permit, and we're spending $250 million a year to do that, and it includes people who carry paint, fingernail polish remover, Listerine, and Coke syrup. That's how we're spending your tax dollars, $250 million a year to make sure somebody doesn't make a bomb out of Coke syrup or Listerine. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, and this was $300 worth of baby blankies, and it took 4 days. Actually, I missed several deadlines because I could not receive the product. And I was just mystified by what's all the fuss over textiles.
Yeah. And so now that's just an individual example with you. And that's obviously a hassle for you, but I'm worried about we live in a just-in-time global economic system. And like I say, our largest trading partner is Canada, and some of the foolish things we do that causes disruptions to that, well, makes us our own worst enemy. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, but can you explain, Colonel Larson, why Homeland Security would be concerned about baby blankies or textiles?
I have no clue, but I know they're concerned about people who drive around a truck with Listerine and Coke syrup.
Yeah, so
explain that one to me, Joy.
Right. I mean, yeah, no. What do you make? I mean, are we talk a little bit about the current state of airport security and the various changing regulations with that? I think now we can bring lighters, butane lighters, on an airplane. They're not afraid of us, I guess, lighting our shoe bombs. But
I actually like Kip Holly, who's the head of TSA. He's got an incredibly difficult job, and I beat Kip up all the time about this thing with fingerprinting people carrying Coke syrup and Listerine. Other things, though, I wrote an op-ed about him last year in the Wall Street Journal. I said, well, let's give the man some credit. When he first came in, he said, okay, I want to change the rules. I don't want my people focused on 3-inch knives, knitting needles, and fingernail clippers, okay, since I'm worried about people bringing bombs on airplanes. And he got beat up pretty good in the press and Congress about, oh, now you're going to let them carry those little knives on the airplane or whatever. And then we found out that 10 people wanted to bring on liquid bombs in London, put them on 10 airplanes. The man was about a year ahead of the terrorists, which is where we need our government leaders. So he's got a tough job. You know, we all want to get to the airport and, okay, 30 minutes before our flight, jump on the airplane and go. And he has to find this balance between security and convenience. I feel very comfortable when I and my daughter go to the airport and get on a commercial flight today. So that's good. And now airline travel is back above the 9/11 level. It's a very challenging job. I am concerned that, my 83-year-old mother kind of goes through secondary screening sometime and gets all this scrutiny. But the people who clean the bathrooms on the airplanes do not go through any screening, and a large percentage of those are illegal immigrants. So I'm telling you, there's concerns about other security aspects to the airport, but generally speaking, I do not worry personally. I mean, I'm a guy who spends 7 days a week thinking about this, but when I go get on the airliner, I'm much more worried about, am I going to get there on time than whether I'm going to be hijacked or whatever. So I think TSA has done a reasonably good job. I know it's frustrating. People go, well, now they finally fixed this thing. Some people say, well, some places I take off my shoes and some places I don't, whatever. Well, if you think that's frustrating to you, believe me, that's even far more frustrating to a terrorist, because terrorists hate things that are not predictable. Yeah. So TSA, you know, I'll give them a grade of a C. I'm sure they could do things better, but and particularly about some of the areas about the Coke syrup and whatever, because it's not just the airports they cover. But the good news is I think we all feel secure going to the airport today.
Well, even though there have been some plots broken up that did include airplanes and terrorists, we also hear from some that, you know what, maybe the next terrorist attack isn't going to involve an airplane in any way, shape, or form, because been there, done that.
Oh, absolutely. I, these folks are creative. If they see things that are, we have significantly increased the security, they're going to go for the easy place. I seriously would doubt that it would be that, particularly now that we have the liquid thing. They saw that was a weakness about this. We weren't watching for the liquid bombs, and so thank God that the Brits did a great job in disrupting that. So it's good that we can all feel secure going, and it's a little bit inconvenient, but it's not that bad. Come on, you know, I don't know about your airport at Reagan National Airport. I'm usually through security in 10 minutes.
Right. Tony in Greenwood, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Colonel. My theory has always been it's not the bomb to worry about, it's the mass civil disobedience that would ensue as a result of which. Is there a growing industry, or is there an industry for the leaders of industry to, or legislators, to have a go-to plan that in a paramilitary maneuver they would be retrieved from the eye of the hurricane and brought to a safe place as the president has his retreat in the mountain in Virginia?
So for this is for, you say, for government leaders in a local area that was a huge disaster?
Well, I'm referring to actually not only for legislators or leaders, but even for, you know, the leaders of industry to not go back to their home and dial 911 and get a fast, busy signal. Is there an industry that would retrieve, the president of General Motors?
No, you know, the major corporations, and I talk about them in Chapter 7 in the book, have extensive business continuity plans. And so I am sure that they're not going to share that information with me. That's going to be very privately held. They've shared a lot of their information about their business continuity plans. But I would highly suspect that the top business executives do have plans for that in a major disaster. What's very important is our major companies have plans to reconstitute, get their businesses back operating. I give two specific examples of businesses that completely reestablished, even though they were in the World Trade Center, and of course the buildings totally collapsed. The big problem I highlight in the book is, you know, 90% of businesses in America are small businesses, and they have not taken the time to do the business continuity plans, and I think that is critically important. In getting a community reestablished is by getting those businesses back open.
Colonel Larson, we're out of time. Thanks a lot for being with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Joy.
Randall Larson, retired Colonel, U.S. Air Force, Director of the Institute for Homeland Security. He is the author of Our Own Worst Enemy, Asking the Right Questions About Security to Protect You, Your Family, and America. And has a lot of information about how you can personally be prepared for an emergency or some sort of natural or man-made disaster. Thanks to Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.